The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 17th day of April. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the great former goaltender of the New York Rangers, J.D. John Davidson, will join us. In the second half, we'll talk to author Greg W. Prince about his new book, Amazing Again, How the 2015 New York Mets Brought the Magic Back to Queens. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page called Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. Stop by, give us a look, then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest is the president of hockey operations of the Columbus Blue Jackets and a former goaltender for the St. Louis Blues and, more importantly, the New York Rangers. He's also well known for his career as a longtime hockey broadcaster. In 2009, it was announced that John would be honored by the Hockey Hall of Fame with the Foster Hewitt Memorial Award for his contributions to broadcasting. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, J.D., John Davidson. J.D., good evening.
Hi there. How are you doing, Bill?
It's great to have you, and hope you're having a great night.
Yeah, it's been good. I've been watching some hockey today. I'm in Columbus. We had ourselves an 80-degree day here today.
Oh, so nice.
Spring has sprung.
And, yeah.
Unfortunately, we're not in the playoffs, but at least get a chance to watch.
Right, yeah, the Isles will be starting up momentarily. So a lot of people focused in on that, I can imagine. Now, you grew up in Western Canada, John. Who did you root for out there when you were a kid? Favorite teams, favorite players?
Actually, when I was a young boy and first got into hockey and on television, there was only six teams in the league way back then.
Uh-huh.
And I was a Montreal Canadian fan for whatever reason, and watched a lot of hockey on Hockey Night in Canada, which was Saturday nights in our household. And it was a battle. I was the only Montreal fan. The rest of the house, including my father and mother, were Toronto Maple Leaf fans. So it got a little bit testy now and again, but it was great to welcome the Hockey Night in Canada into our homes and be able to watch it. It gave us a read on hockey.
I'm sure, yeah. Now, you seem to have it all when you started out. You had the size. You had the agility. St. Louis made quick use of you. You started 39 games for the Blues. But the team had problems in the front line. Talk to us a little bit about those days in St. Louis.
Well, it was actually great. I was there for mm-hmm. 2 years. My first season was a real good season until I blew a knee with about, I guess it was 6 or 7 weeks left this season, and that really hurt me. That was the year that Dennis Potvin won the Rookie of the Year, deservedly so, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And the next season, my first season was a good season. I was only 19 years of age. I was the first goaltender ever to jump directly from junior hockey into the National Hockey League. And then my second season, I struggled, went through a lot of different things. And during the offseason, was traded to the Rangers. It was surprising, but it was also something that ended up being very, very good for me. Going back to the 2 years in St. Louis, it was outstanding. It's a great sports city. I'm sure people listening know about the Cardinals and the Rams before it was the Cardinals, the football team, and Cardinals, mm-hmm. the baseball team, and the Blues and all their history. It's just a tremendous city, a great place to live, and I really enjoyed it. And then was moved during the off season to New York, and that was the start of a great amount of years for me, whether it be playing or broadcasting or just living and learning about life in New York, learning about sports in New York, learning how to compete a little bit better, learning to get tougher. It was just a spectacular time for us.
I can imagine, JD. Now, I was looking through some of the rosters of those St. Louis teams.
Yeah.
Some real classic hockey names from that era. Gary Unger, Red Berenson, one of the Plager brothers was
actually,
on the
club. Brothers
oh,
there.
Both of them. Okay, yeah. Some real classic hockey names.
Yeah. it was great. I still run into Red Berenson. He coaches Michigan, the college team there, still coaches. He was a legendary, and is a legendary, hockey coach, hockey man. He actually scored 6 goals in 1 game for the Blues against the Philadelphia Flyers, which was quite something. The Plager brothers, they're still, Barkley was our captain. He passed away due to a brain tumor a number of years ago, but what a competitor. And Bobby, his brother, still in St. Louis, still working with the Blues. Special people. Gary Unger was from the Calgary area, where I'm from. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, he took care of me. He loaned me one of his cars and made sure I did this and that and this and that. And basically took care of me. And I've always told that story when I got into management, it's up to players to make sure that you take care of younger players so you can, so they have something that's special, because if people help you, you help others.
Great
that,
point.
That really was a very interesting time in St. Louis. We had great ownership with the Solomon family, and played in the old, what they called the old barn, which is no longer there. And then on top of that, it was also a funny situation. We had quite a number of coaches of the 2 years that I was there. It was really something to see.
Yeah, good, great point. Great point, JD. Now, you came to the Rangers. You had a chance to play with Eddie Jockeman, Rod Gilbert, Kachuk, some of those classic Rangers, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, it was special. I got there, and, Eddie Jockeman was still there. I ended up moving him to Detroit, and that was quite a shock when that happened to me. I was just a young guy, and he was legendary in New York. Never forget Eddie's first game back when he stopped. It seemed like 100 shots. I think it was probably the mid-40s. He was outstanding and beat us. I played at the other end. The next time they came in, my shutout was to beat Detroit. which was at least something at the time. But I was treated well by the veteran players there. Walter Kachuk. I was there when he was lost vision at the one eye and had to retire. Roger, I just saw him at the at the All-Star game this winter in Nashville. He and his wife Judy were there, and we had a sit-down glass of wine and reminisce some. He's just a terrific guy. You know what was interesting is with the Islanders and the Rangers, the rivalry was just fantastic. I had played junior hockey with Bobby Nystrom. He was just a tremendous man. And after all that was said and done, and the rivalries and playing, and the Islanders had their success, we didn't have as much. But you see each other a number of times in different areas, whether it be at the Hall of Fame weekend. I run into Billy Smith there. It seems like every year he's there, and we have a beer or a Diet Coke or whatever together, and a laugh about the old days. It's something that's very special for me. I loved every minute of it. They were great battles, and a lot of us have been able to catch up as we've moved along.
Speaking of John Davidson tonight on Sports Talk 1240, how about that 79 Stanley Cup semifinal against the Islanders? Speaking of the gentleman from the Nassau Coliseum, that was an upset and a great series, wasn't it?
It was a great series. It was close. It could have gone either way for sure. The Islanders took care of business the next 4 years. I know that.
Yeah.
We were the first ones and last ones to beat them, and then they went on a streak that was remarkable. But they were great games, even during regular season, playoffs aside. Just great hockey players. You know, you look over there and with Billy and Chico and Goal and Potvin and Langevin and all kinds of guys on the blue line, up front with Trottier and Bossy and Wayne Merrick. Wayne Merrick actually was a teammate of mine in St. Louis.
Exactly, right.
He was a roommate of mine, actually, my first year pro.
Had some good years, too.
You sit back, and that's, I know it was a long, long, long time ago, but it was just, it was good, hard fought, for the most part, real clean hockey, too, between the two teams. It was hard, and that's the way it's supposed to be. It's a tough game, but they were hard fought battles, well coached on both sides. It was fantastic stuff. I talk a lot with Bill Torrey, the former general manager there. And he's on the Hall of Fame Selecting Committee. I'm the chairman of the Hall of Fame Selecting Committee. So we talked a lot throughout the winter about ex-players who maybe could be nominated or voted in or whatever it is. Whenever we have a chance and we run into each other, we tell stories. And, man, he can tell stories. So it's a lot of fun.
The bow tie, Bill Toria. Yep. He's with the Florida Panthers now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now you went from those Rangers with Esposito and Middleton, Ferguson as the coach, to what I call the Sassoon Rangers, with Andy Hedberg, Ulf Nielsen, Duguay, Greschner. Talk a little bit about that club.
That was essentially the team that went to the finals in '79.
Right.
It was a good team with guys like Carol Vadney, who just passed away within the last year or so.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Esposito was my roommate on the road, and he was one unbelievably competitive hockey player. He just competed. And he still holds the record for most shots on goal in a season. It's 550, if nobody's ever come close. I doubt anybody ever will. It was a team that had a good mix of young players and older players, and ended up that Freddie Shirl
right.
coached us, too. That was after John Ferguson. The John Ferguson days were, they brought in a lot of young players, really young players, myself included, with David Farish, Mike McEwen, just a whole bunch of those guys, Ron Duguay, both Maloney's, Donnie and Dave, and amongst many others. So it was a growing period, and then we got hot that one year and got to the finals and lost to Montreal. And to this day, it still bothers me that we lost to Montreal. We could have won the game four at home and pushed the series to at least six games. Instead, we lost in five. I also blew a knee in that one, mm-hmm. which didn't help. But they were great days. To light up Madison Square Garden is a very special thing. I talk here. I can talk for hours about the good things that happened playing and living in New York. Just, it's a special place. Some of the players we've traded New York from here or St. Louis, I've always told them, you're going to go to a special place. You're going to go somewhere where it's going to be an experience you'll never, ever, ever have again. Enjoy it, embrace it, play well. And a lot of these guys have come up to me after and said, boy, yeah, that's something else. Well, you told us what to expect. This is something. It's fantastic. When you turn up the heat in Madison Square Garden, you can handle it. It's a pretty good place.
Exactly. Yeah. The Mecca. Now, you also had a chance, JD, to play for the great Herb Brooks.
Yes. Yeah, I coached with Herbie, too. He allowed me to be part of the staff one time, and I just huge respect for Herb Brooks. He is an individual who was a follower. He was ahead of himself, the vision about our game. Really neat guy. I'll tell you a story.
Sure.
I had a golf tournament out in Western Canada where I'd spend part of my summer. And it was for the Crohn's Colitis Foundation. I have family that had issues there. So I walked the golf course about 5 in the afternoon and a hot day in the mountains. And I had about 15 messages. And I finally got to my phone. Sure enough, Herbie had been killed that day. It was with the rollover car. From what I understand, was not wearing his seatbelt and got tossed out of the vehicle and died. So I stopped in St. Paul on the way back to New York and went to his funeral. And then what was something is I got back with my family to Westchester, and I got my I looked at the phone machine, and I had, it was 46 messages. He'd been gone for quite a bit of time. And I played all, every single one of them, down to number two, and it was Herb Brooks.
Oh, boy.
And he was calling me to get together on a business deal, give him a call, blah, 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 and I didn't realize he had called. And I'm telling you something, that just sent shivers right through my whole body. It was quite something.
I can imagine, J.D. Oh, boy, what an experience. Now, you played, as we said, on that 79 club that went to battle with the Montreal Canadiens in the finals. Guys like Jacques Lemaire, Kenny Dryden in the net, Serge Savard, Guy Lafleur. Did the Rangers really belong in that series?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
You know, they had, it seemed like, 15 Hall of Famers that played
on
that team.
They always
do. We won game one. And we had a lead in game two. And what happened, what happened was in warm-up for game two, they were making a change to play Bunny LaRocque in goal as opposed to Ken Dryden, who was the losing goalie in game one. And to our chagrin, Doug Riseborough, a player for them, took a slap shot and hit Bunny LaRocque right between the eyes with a puck and knocked Bunny out, and then Ken had to play. And we all know about his career. I mean, he's just some kind of goalie. But anyway, we took a 2-0 lead, and the fans were booing and upset. And here we are, up a game, up 2-0 in game two, and then it all changed. They got they just changed. They just started playing, and we couldn't get the job done. We lost that game, and then we went home and lost two. They were close games. One of them was in overtime, and it was a 2-on-1 where Serge Savard had Guy Lafleur with him. I'm pretty sure that's what it is, and I cheated as a goalie thinking he was going to pass it to Lafleur, the forward, the great goal scorer, and he didn't. He scored on the short side. And Serge and I are pretty good friends, and every single time I see him, which is probably twice a year, he just rubs it in. To this day, here we are in 2016, he's still rubbing it in.
Well, these guys love that. Yeah, they love it. Yeah. Now, I remember you as number 30, John.
Yeah.
You also wore 35 and 00. Now, the interesting story about 00 is, do you know who the only other guy to wear 00 was in the NHL?
Marty Biron.
That's right. The league banned the use of that number. Why did they do that?
I don't know, but it wasn't very smart.
Yeah.
Here's what happened was when Phil Esposito was traded to the Rangers, he had worn 7 in Boston all those years. He was a great player. He got to New York, and 7 was taken by another great player, Rod Gilbert, who was also in the Hall of Fame. So Phil came up with the idea of 77, and he wanted some help, and so he asked me if I'd wear 00, and he'd wear 77, and I was just a kid and pretty naive, and I said, absolutely, Phil. Sure will. Well, I did. And it just invited aggravation. You go on the road and people would yell, is that your IQ? Or, certainly not your goals against average.
How many friends you have? Yeah.
All that stuff. It was aggravating. Number 30 was my favorite number. I wore it in St. Louis and for a time with the Rangers too. And I think Villavier was also number 30.
He was.
With the Rangers. So, that was the number I liked.
Is there any truth, John, to the rumor? Now, I did this. I found this while I was doing my homework, and I also believe it's on the Rangers website that Foreigner's tune "Double Vision" was written about you.
Certainly the name "Double Vision." Yes, I was playing in a game. They were in a hotel, the group, and I got to know Lou Graham, nice man, the lead singer, who lived in Westchester County and had moved to Rochester last night. But anyway,
right.
They were writing some music and watching a hockey game, and I got dinged and knocked out with a shot up between the eyes again. And they came up with Double Vision, so I'm famous for getting hit in the head with a puck.
Yeah.
and they named the tune Double Vision. And I'd heard about it, wasn't real sure, that I saw a group of them being interviewed a few years ago about the song, and they brought up the whole story and right on television. So I certainly know it's true.
There you go.
And at least it's interesting.
Immortality strikes again. Now the mask you wore was pretty unique. Back then, now they're all airbrushed and they're big fancy pieces of artwork. Who did that mask? Did somebody design it for you? And was it influenced by any other guys?
No, it wasn't influenced by anybody. I can't remember who did it, I'm being honest about that. But I still have it. It's downstairs in my home here. I had another one that was a pretty interesting one. It was a Lone Ranger one with some silver bullets on it and stuff like that. And it actually was stolen. And I thought I was going to get it back. It had gone up for sale at Christie's Auction House in New York.
Oh.
And I contacted some people and blah, blah, blah. And I thought I was going to make a trade, give the guy a couple of sticks, get my mask back. Never came to fruition. And I never saw that mask again. I don't know where it is or who's gotten it and what they paid for it, but it was mine and it was stolen.
Oh, boy.
The one that I had with the red and the stripes up
right.
and down, the blue and the red and the white. It was an interesting mask. It was just fiberglass. It was form-fitted to your face. I wore nothing on the inside of it because I couldn't put padding on the inside to have it stick, but I could properly. So I didn't wear anything on the inside, just pressed up against my face. And if you happen to get hit with a puck or a stick waving out of puck and missed and hit the mask, it wasn't very, it stopped the cutting, but it didn't stop the jarring feeling you got compared to today. Today you see Henrik Lundqvist try to take pucks with his head and head them away like you do a soccer ball.
Yeah.
It's remarkable. In fact, it's remarkable to watch goalies today play the game because they have no fear of injury compared to our days. And the players shoot the puck better now and harder now as a group, without question. We still had people like Bobby Hull and others that could shoot it as good as anybody today, but we didn't have very many that could do that. However, the equipment wasn't very good, and we got bruised up, banged up, and you tried to get through practices without getting badly hurt, and games, you got lucky if you got through it, and you ended up with bruises all over your arms and inner thighs. And today, there's no such thing.
They're absolutely gladiators out there. You look at the early pictures, John, of Johnny Bauer and Glenn Hall and Eddie Jockman in the early days, and they look like they're out there with nothing underneath the sweater.
Oh yeah, I found an old pair of gloves, my last set I wore, and it's actually my nephew who's a goaltender. He looked at them and started laughing. Compared to today, he's absolutely right. I was kind of embarrassed looking at them.
That's
just the way it was. I think that equipment today has to be formulated where it protects the goaltender because they shoot it well. But it's just out of control. The catching gloves, you hardly catch the puck anymore. It's kind of a block or two. You could take those gloves and go to a small stream, reach down and scoop up trout.
Exactly.
They're so massive compared to our day. I don't mind. You know, there's evolution, and things should get better and protect people. But when it's so big, the pants, the shoulder pads. I've seen goaltenders wear a set of arm pads and then another set on top.
Whoa.
It's just crazy.
Yeah,
but I'm not the one to make the rules.
Exactly. Well, taking a look back at your Emmy Award-winning broadcasting career, John, what has to be the number one moment or the great moments that you remember as a broadcaster?
You know, I try to look at all that with just gratitude that I was given a chance at a young age. I retired at 28 or 29 because of injuries, and I was given a chance to stay in the game, and I probably worked harder at that than I did as a player. The playing stuff came natural and enjoyed it a lot. But the second opportunity was something I had to make sure I did it right and worked at it. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed everywhere I went. 5 Olympics, the Rangers winning the Cup in 94 was really a special time. A lot of it for the people involved with the Rangers, but also for those fans, when you think of all those decades without a championship. It's a remarkable thing. I remember things like my very first interview I ever did, and that was with Bill Torrey at Madison Square Garden. My right hand holding the mic was shaking so bad because I was nervous that I almost chipped his teeth. And he was so polite and never acted like, who is this lunatic holding this microphone with his hand shaking type of thing. You know, I can the days of working with Sam Rosen. One of the most, I think Sam Rosen is a New York treasure. That's what I think.
Yeah.
I think if people knew what Sam Rosen does with his off time, how many charity events and where he goes to help raise funds, he's had a remarkable impact for what he does. He loves sports. He loves all teams. He loves baseball. He loves football. He loves hockey. He loves boxing. All those years with E&L's boxing. And just has had a passion for life on top of it. And a passion for New York. So when I look at my broadcasting career and I think of some of the good things that happened, I was just, again, a lucky guy to be in the right place at the right time, Madison Square Garden. That group, MSG Network, to work for them was special. They let us go and do network stuff. Let me go and do the Olympics along with the Rangers, 5 of them all over the world. they were just a fantastic place to work. Absolutely fantastic.
Great. Well, you're running the show now in Columbus, J.D. You're an alternate governor out there. For the edification of the folks, we have a few minutes left. What's the role of the alternate governor with a hockey club?
Well, the governor is actually the owner of our hockey club.
Okay.
And a lot of times he can't go to the meetings. I go to all of them, to the board of governor meetings. And if he's not there, I'm there. I become the voting member. And along with another fellow, Mike Priest, who works with us too. It's just you're there helping make decisions with the ownership of the league, trying to make the league a better place, which is outstanding. Columbus, you know, when I left New York, I was actually headed to St. Louis with Dave Checketts and Mike McCarthy and the guys, all out of Madison Square Garden too. And I had gotten tired. I had announced 153 games the season before, and I was just worn out, and I wanted a new challenge. So I went out there, and we had to rebuild the Blues, and it took quite a bit of time. And right now, they're a good hockey club. About two-thirds of the players on that team are ones that we were involved with drafting and trading for and everything else. And it's gratifying to see them play well. Now I'm doing the same thing here in Columbus, trying to rebuild the franchise, and we took a step backwards this season without question, but I think given our situation and the amount of young talent we've drafted, going to continue with, we should have a bright future here, but it's not an easy thing to rebuild a franchise, I can tell you that.
You're exactly right, John. Well, we wish you the best of luck out there. It's been great speaking with you tonight, talking some hockey and about the Rangers. I thank you for sharing part of your Sunday night with us.
Thank you, Bill. I really enjoyed it. All the best to you.
To you too, John. John Davidson, ladies and gentlemen. Up next, we'll talk to author Greg W. Prince about his book, Amazing Again, How the 2015 New York Mets Brought the Magic Back to Queens. Stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SPORTSTALK1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SPORTSTALK1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines. Also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. Great sports weekend that we're going through right now with the baseball and the Stanley Cup playoffs in progress. And if you're with us there out there, I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Well, my next guest is the co-creator of the blog Faith and Fear in Flushing. He has written about baseball for the New York Times, the Huffington Post, Yahoo Sports, and ESPN.com. He served as a consultant to the film The Last Play at Shea and helped organize the New York Mets' 50th anniversary conference at Hofstra University. He has a new book out entitled Amazing Again, How the 2015 New York Mets Brought the Magic Back to Queens. I welcome to the show tonight Greg W. Prince. Greg, good evening.
Good evening. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Talk some Mets. Of course, the Mets were your favorite team growing up, Greg. I'm going to assume that.
Yeah.
Who were your favorite players?
Oh, started in 1969, so it started with Tom Seaver.
Okay.
And everything has sort of followed in the wake of Tom. But really, you know, we're talking now my 48th season as a fan.
More than you want to count, I know.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, that's one of the strange things about, you know, the march of time is that you're kind of, if you were born the same year as the Mets were, as I was, you tend to think of the Mets as something that just came along, and now, you know, you see 50 years ago today, such and such happened to the New York Mets, and it's like, how is that even possible?
Right.
But it does go on, and occasionally they give us some thrills, as they did last year, as they did this afternoon, for that matter.
Exactly. Finally won another one. Boy, does it get me down when they lose and when I see a guy like Harvey not come through like he did yesterday.
You know, they can't win every day. It feels like they can and they should because of this pitching, but there have been some early season stumbling blocks, but Steve Matz looked great today.
He sure did.
Like me, a Long Island kid, so I'm very
right.
proud of him, and hopefully they'll keep it up.
Now, this fine book that you wrote, Greg, it traces the trajectory of the 2015 championship season from the roots based long ago in the amateur draft to the culmination in Citi Field's first World Series. What gave you the idea to start back at the roots, really?
I'm, as you can imagine, for somebody who has been, you know, watching this team for an entire lifetime, basically, I like to kind of go back and see how we got here. And I can't take complete credit for the concept of the amateur draft. In this case, I did read an article on the late lamented Grantland site a couple of years ago that talked about transaction trees, I think they called them, who had the longest roots on a major league roster today. And as it turned out, if you looked at David Wright, you kind of saw how the Mets got him because Mike Hampton left as a free agent. They got an extra pick. Well, they got Hampton because they traded Roger Cedeno, and they got Cedeno because they traded a minor leaguer named Arnold Gooch, and they got Gooch because...
The immortal, yeah.
Yeah, the immortal Arnold Gooch, who came for Brett Saberhagen. I'm leaving a lot of guys out who also came in these deals, but you trace it all the way back. You go back to John Matlack in 1967, the number one pick. So I sort of, you know, took my cue from that Grantland article and kind of delved into the history of that. I guess the two things that struck me in doing that, other than having a kind of be able to build a foundation for the 2015 Mets and say how we got here, two things. One, that when the Mets signed Matlack in 67, it was part of a larger organizational philosophy, which was let's sign lots of young arms who were already just that year beginning to pay off. Tom Seaver was, you know, Rookie of the Year. Jerry Kuzman would win 19 games the next year. And I thought that was kind of a kind of set the stage for an echo, you know, more than 45 years later with the kind of pitching staff the Mets had today. The other thing that struck me in doing my research on this little aspect of it is the day David Wright was born was the day Pete Falcone played his part in the chain of events that led to his being drafted, because Pete Falcone signed as a free agent on December 20th, 1982 with the Braves. The Mets got a draft pick, which they used on Stanley Jefferson, who may ring a bell, a outfielder briefly on the 86 Mets, who went for Kevin McReynolds in the what was better known as the Kevin Mitchell trade.
Right.
And again, that McReynolds eventually brought Saberhagen, and like I said, it goes all the way back to Matlack. You can do the math, or you can read the book.
It's a family tree. It's like a 6 degrees of separation, and it really tells the story. You talk about David Wright being the cornerstone, and then you talk about success having two daddies. Now let's talk a little bit about that in the roots portion of the book.
Sure. The two daddies in this case are Omar Minaya and Sandy Alderson. I had read a lot of books when I was a kid about the 69 Mets. Again, I was 6 years old when they won the World Series, and I didn't know the whole story behind them. So I would go to the Long Beach Public Library. I grew up in Long Beach listening to WGBB, by the way, as a kid, and not just for school clothing.
Thanks for the plug.
No problem. Yeah. Anyway, one of the books I remember reading talked about how the various Mets who formed the 69 Mets came to wind up on the team. Well, in trying to kind of get that across, what struck me most was that there was a faction of players who came along during the Omar Minaya era, if you will, when he was the general manager, and there were those who came along when Sandy Alderson was general manager. It's kind of a parlor game for Mets fans online to kind of argue over who was more responsible for building a championship team. There are people who, I guess, just don't want to give Alderson credit. There are people who wanted to forget Minaya ever happened.
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting that a lot of the guys who were minor leaguers under Minaya, guys like Jacob deGrom, guys like Steve and Matt, Matt Harvey, who was his last draft pick, Juan Lagares comes to mind, that those guys blossomed later. And, it's to Minaya's credit that he scouted them or signed off on them. It is to Alderson's credit that his organization helped develop them and didn't trade them. And, of course, Alderson picks up the gauntlet, didn't have that much money to spend on free agents for a couple of years. So, he had to make some shrewd moves, traded perhaps Minaya's greatest major league find, which was R.A. Dickey, a guy he got off the scrap heap, who, of course, blossomed into a Cy Young winner. And he turned him into Noah Syndergaard and Travis d'Arnaud in what I think will go down as one of the great trades in Mets history.
Not too bad. Yeah.
Yeah, so, you got two architects, basically, one who was active and, one who helped, lay a foundation. And, you have to give a shout-out, I suppose, to Steve Phillips, who was the guy who drafted David Wright as well. So, and of course, those are just the guys at the head of the organization. They're scouts, they're assistant general managers, they're farm system directors, the whole bit. So, it's not like these 25 guys who entered, who lined up on the field at Kauffman Stadium for Game 1 last year just wound up there all at once. And of course, it's not like, they all could be traced back to 1967 or 2010 because, they were still wheeling and dealing, right up to September.
Right. It's a long, strange trip, definitely. Now, you talk about Greg. We've got Greg Prince with us tonight talking about his new book, Amazing Again. You talk about the club getting going, getting stuck, and then getting going again because there were times last year when you could look at portions of the season and there's no way you're thinking this team's going to the World Series.
No, the team was blessed, or blessed itself, I suppose, with a fabulous start. A year ago at this time, they were beginning to reel off 11 wins in a row, which I think set the tone for higher expectations and separated themselves from the presumed favorites, the Washington Nationals, and that all kind of got wiped away by late May. Into June because the Mets suffered some injuries and they just stopped hitting. There was no depth to speak of. And it really looked like they were going to fall off a cliff, which would have been a shame because they were pitching great. The young pitching really was as advertised, but they could not generate a run. And there are many choices for the bottoming out of the 2015 Mets, but for the one I will never forget, the three-game series against the Cubs as June became July. I went to two of those games. In three games, the Mets scored one run against a playoff-caliber team, and they were headed to California to take on a great pitching staff in L.A. and a defending world champion in San Francisco, and you're thinking, come on, boys, it's now or never. And although there was still a ways to go in terms of proving themselves, they came home 4-2. From that trip, they kind of held their own. Things could have been worse after the All-Star break. There was one particularly traumatic week that I think Mets fans will know what I'm talking about when I refer to it, the night that they almost traded Wilmer Flores for Carlos Gomez. And then the next day when they blew a, I guess it was a 6-run lead, and the rains came, and Jairus Familia, who had been gold, unfortunately tarnished in the rain against the Padres. And I don't think anybody would have given a plug nickel for their chances on the
That was a tough one to swallow, Greg, that ball game,
Yeah, the afternoon of July 30th, it was not looking good, but just to show that it's a long season, and you use baseball doesn't have a clock, but it does have a calendar, and Alderson used the next day to bring us Yoenis Cespedes on top of the guys he had brought in the previous week, promoting Michael Conforto, bringing in Kelly Johnson, Juan Uribe, and Tyler Clippard. It was kind of a new team on the fly. Guys were coming off of injuries as well, and the Washington Nationals came to town with a 3-game lead, and the Mets sent them packing with a tie for first place, and they never really looked back.
Exactly. That was when I guess that's how the team got rolling again. You talk about the stenosis. Now, I have spinal stenosis, Greg, so I know the deal with that. I have trouble throwing a first base myself. Mm-hmm. So I know how difficult that is. Talk a little bit about David Wright coming back into the lineup. I recall the first at bat in Citizens Bank Ballpark. You can tell us about that and how the Mets get moving again.
Sure. The Mets had taken off in August, as I just mentioned, and there had been a fantastic series in Colorado where Cespedes came alive, had a 3-home run night. It was a classic Denver Mile High 14-9 two nights in a row type of series. And then as a bonus, David Wright, again, the senior man on the team, been around since 2004 with roots going back to 1967, 15 years before he was born, and he steps up at Citizens Bank Park, and he lofts a home run in his very first at bat for a guy who, again, and since you know what he was going through on some level, for a guy who people were talking about, well, he may never come back, but if he comes back, he'll never produce anything again. And honestly, we all got our degrees in spinal stenosis studies, from reading, one or two articles or going on Wikipedia or something.
Right.
None of us really knew what we were talking about, but David Wright, worked his back off, if you will, and hit a home run on a night where the Mets would hit 8 home runs, which became a franchise record, and they effected a sweep of the Phillies in the process. And it was a nice, I don't know if an exclamation point, because they still had to beat the Nationals one more time, still had to clinch, but it was a very nice semicolon, to put it that part of the season. It was really great for every Mets fan who had watched David Wright, sort of carry the team on his shoulders, which may be how he got spinal stenosis. So to watch him finally be in the middle of a pennant race once more for the first time in about 8 years, it was a great thing.
It really was. We've got Greg Prince with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240 talking about his new book, Amazing Again, the 2015 Mets. You talk about the Washington Nationals and how they sent them packing in that series, Greg. They really embarrassed them, so to speak. They really looked terrible down the stretch, and the Mets just pulled away.
Yeah, I mean, the Nationals certainly had the talent, and you would have figured, even though they'd had some injuries, that they had the depth. I mean, you go back about 12 and a half months, read every season preview for 2015, and there was no doubt the Nationals were going to win the National League East.
Right.
Quite possibly win the World Series, and it just goes to show you play baseball to find out if those things are true. And in their case, whether it was injuries, whether it was underperformance, whether Matt Williams was just not the right guy to have at the helm and made things tighter than they needed to be, and whether one of the worst deals in baseball last year was going out and getting Jonathan Papelbon, which was essentially adding fuel to the fire in that clubhouse, it all backfired, and the Mets were there to take advantage. And that the 3-game series in September, when the Nationals were still within conceptual reach of making it a race, I talked about coming into this thing in 1969. One of my earliest memories was the Mets taking those two games from the Cubs on their way to being able to say, look who's number one.
Definitely.
It was kind of like that. It was on the anniversary of the Black Cat game, I think, where they swept the series. The Nationals had leads in all three games, and the Mets stormed back. One of them, they were, you know, sort of the flip side of that Justin Upton home run off of Familia game. You know, they came from, I think, six runs down, and it was, you know, from there, it was just a matter of time before they clinched.
Clinching and getting to the playoffs, Greg, to me, that was the end of it. I thought that's where it would end. Anything else was gravy. They were playing with house money after that, to me. Getting by L.A. really showed you that this team could have legs.
Yeah, I think there was this sense right up to the moment they got the last out in Game 5 at Dodger Stadium that somehow the Mets were going to let us down in a profound way. And that the, you know, never mind a division title, never mind 90 wins, you know, you're not going to be able to beat a team that throws Kershaw and Greinke at you.
Right.
And you don't have home field advantage. And, you know, so somehow they you know, forces will conspire against them, as they did in Game 2 with Chase Utley taking out Ruben Tejada, and yet Chase Utley is somehow ruled safe. But, you know, the fact that they hung so tough in that game, that DeGrom has the bad first inning or two and is in trouble just about every inning, and somehow the Dodgers never score more than two runs. And the fact that Daniel Murphy just absolutely, you know, single-handedly takes care of the offense, whether it's a home run, whether, you know, he drives in the first run, whether he steals third base on a walk when nobody's looking. And, you know, Syndergaard comes in, throws in relief for the first time in his major league career. Familia gets two innings, which was pretty unusual. There was something about that game that said, you know what, this is not for naught. This team did not let us down. They are no longer suspect. And I think there was just always this feeling that, gosh, the Mets, really for about 20-plus years, were somehow going to find a way to make you say, ugh. But, you know, after that, I think the house money really did come into play.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they didn't let us down. And you couldn't have blamed them if they had lost to the Cubs either. Cubs were a terrific team, and, you know, that worked out well, too.
With the Dodger series, too, you had to fight off that little maggot, Justin Turner, who was killing them.
Justin Turner, who apparently had a bit of a grudge for his old team. I forget what the exact quotes were, but I remember there was some sort of one Met source said something, you know, he didn't hustle or whatever it was on his way out the door, and perhaps that motivated him. Perhaps just Turner figured out how to hit later in his career. But, yeah, he was a scary, probably as much as Adrian Gonzalez, a scary sight in that series. And I think
like a bad penny.
Yeah, I think he hit about 500 in that series, but the Mets overcame him.
Now, as you say, going forward to face Chicago in the championship series, clearly the Cubs, as they are this year, a great ball club, as we said. As we said also, the house money comes into play. I never thought they'd get by the Cubs, but they handled that series even more handily than they did the L.A. Dodgers.
Yeah, they just, you know, they hit a groove in the road, and they took off. I don't know how else to explain it other than, you know, they outpitched the Cubs, they outhit the Cubs, they certainly outfielded the Cubs, they outran the Cubs. Remember, this is the Cub team that, like I said before, held them to one run in three games.
Mm-hmm.
A somewhat different roster at that point of the season. And there's a team that won 97 games, and it's a team the Mets didn't beat at Wrigley either in four games during the regular season. But Murphy, obviously on fire, a home run every night. And, you know, even the bounces that didn't go their way, like there was a ball that went up into the ivy that cost the Mets a run, and you sort of hold your breath and say, oh, you know, that's going to come back to haunt us. And, in fact, it didn't. And there was something beautiful about that you know, all the signs that were supposedly, you know, in the Cubs' favor, the idea of Back to the Future 2 taking place on the very night the Mets won the pennant, which was supposed to be the night the Cubs won the World Series in the movie. Well, you know, that's a movie. This was real life. And, somehow the Mets won four in a row off a very good team, and they were off to the World Series.
How did you feel getting ahead of ourselves, Greg, about the Mets not bringing Murphy back after his performance in the postseason last year?
I guess the writing was on the wall the whole time. I mean, Murphy had a tremendous two series against the Dodgers and the Cubs, but we also were reminded of his shortcomings, shall we say, in the field against Kansas City in the World Series. And I don't think they, you know, again, we talked at the beginning about Manaea and Alderson and whose guys were who, which, you know, didn't matter much once they're in the field, but I always had the feeling that this regime was never that attached to Murphy. And, you know, he's at a stage in his career where he was ready to cash in, which is fine, because that's how it works. You know, they offered him the 1 year under the qualifying offer, so it was $15 million or some pittance like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they said, we have Wilson Herrera waiting in the wings. We're trying to sign Ben Zobrist. They wound up with Neil Walker. You know, I thank you for your service, I guess, basically the best way to look at it, as it often is with these guys. But, you know, if you can look back on Daniel Murphy's career and say, you know what we got out of him? We got a pennant out of him. Mm-hmm. He was the MVP of the League Championship Series, and, you know, it was time well spent, and everybody benefited.
You can almost say Citi Field turned into a Shea-type atmosphere this year, which you'd never thought you'd see happen.
Yeah, I think Citi Field had been the architectural version of a cold fish for about you know, the first 6 years. And, you know, as it turned out, well, there was just nothing much to root for. I mean, as much as Mets fans like myself, you know, kept going back and kept trying to generate some enthusiasm while also trying not to be overly sentimental about a facility that, on one hand, you know, had leaks and tight seats and lousy food and everything, but it was, you know, it was Shea, it was ours.
Mm-hmm.
And,
exactly.
You know, it was just hard to let that go, I think, in addition to whatever, you know, Citi Field didn't have going for it in the way of personality and the sense that it was built just, you know, for sponsors and clubs and things like that. But you know what? You put a World Series team and you put 44,000 fans who have been dying for a moment like that all in one place. It doesn't really matter, you know, of all the other stuff. It became the home of the Mets for real last October, and it was a thrill to be a part of it.
Right, yeah, it became home very quickly. You're exactly right. Now, talking about the World Series, they've definitely met their match in the series in 2015. The Royals, just a superior ball club. They never let up. They keep coming at you and really overran the Mets.
Yeah, you know, the Mets, you know, unfortunately experienced what the Nationals experienced in early September. They, you know, just like the Nationals led in every game, the Mets led in every game in the World Series. And it just wouldn't hold. All the things that went well for several weeks and months just didn't. And the Royals, who had been there the year before, came within, you know, one run of winning the whole thing in 2014. You know, they were on a mission. That may not be the most sophisticated, advanced metric way to put it, but it really felt like their World Series from the word go. And, you know, once Murphy makes an error in Game 4, it was really tough to see a way through, because you knew they were going to be down 3-1. I still had hope the next night, you know, Harvey up 2-0 and all of that going into the ninth. But it was their year. And just like the Cub fans may have wondered, how did we lose to the Mets in 4, you know, it was just our year for the pennant. And unfortunately for us, it was the Royals' year to win the World Series. All you can do through gritted teeth is tip one's cap.
Exactly. The reality of the Mets really getting slammed back to earth with that Lucas Duda play, the throw to home plate, really set you back a spell.
Yeah, and, you know, to be fair to Lucas, you know, everybody did at least one major thing wrong, with a couple of exceptions. I mean, Granderson had a nice series. Conforto came around. Syndergaard had a terrific start. But for the most part, everybody was not at their best. And everybody did something to contribute to the loss. So Lucas did it, you know, at the moment when the spotlight was harshest. And I feel bad that, you know, he sort of has to shoulder the blame, or at least did during the off season. But, you know, like we said, it's a new year, and hopefully he will overcome that. There was a play last week where he threw somebody out of the plate from first base. So, Bill Buckner lived to pick up ground balls again for a few years, and I think dude's got a lot more than that left in the tank.
Lucas will live to play another day, yes. Now, we're speaking with Greg Prince tonight about his book, Amazing Again. The foreword in the book is written by none other than the great Howie Rose. That had to be a thrill for you.
Yeah, he is the great Howie Rose, no doubt about it. I've been, like every Met fan old enough, I've been listening to him for a long time and hang on his every word. And, go back to his 5 hours a night hosting on WFAN and WHN before that.
Exactly,
so,
yeah.
I was very, very touched that he saw fit to do that.
The only guy that I was ever nervous with on the radio, Greg, Howie Rose, because he's in the car with you. You're by yourself with Howie Rose. He's like a friend, but yet like an idol, too. And I certainly didn't want to disappoint him. And I was actually nervous talking to Howie on the program.
You know what? I've worked as a journalist. I've interviewed who knows how many hundreds, thousands of people. One of the only times I really felt I choked doing an interview was when Howie was promoting it 2 years ago.
And, amazing.
I got some time on the phone with him, and I could just, I don't know if that I wanted to impress him necessarily, but I wanted to be at my best, and I could kind of feel myself turning into, if you remember, the Chris Farley show where he interviews Paul McCartney,
yeah.
And every question is, "You're Paul McCartney." Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that was it. And he tried to settle me down a little bit, but it wasn't a crowning moment in my radio life, that's for sure. Well, Greg, I tell you, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking time out to be with us. The book is titled Amazing Again, How the 2015 Mets Brought the Magic Back to Queens. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Take care, Greg Prince, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, John Davidson and Greg W. Prince, my engineer, Brian Graves, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you Sunday, May 8th. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.